Hello and welcome to The Wire, independent coverage of current affairs on your local community radio station. I'm Roderick Chambers. Coming up on The Wire today...
Starting from now, emissions are actually projected to increase out to 2030, which is rather astonishing when you think that most people believe that we're actually decreasing our emissions.
Experts have again cast doubt over Australia's ability to reach the emission goal set at the Paris Climate Accord. Incredibly, baseline emissions are set to increase by 2030, not reduce. Also on The Wire today...
Everything was just a normal day. And then we heard the drone of many bombers, and then we saw them come over.
City of Darwin paid tribute to the anniversary of World War II's bombing of Darwin with a special commemorative service this morning. The two Japanese air raids took place on this day in 1943, were the first and largest of more than 100 air raids against Australia that year alone. Stay tuned for this, all this and more on The Wire. Last week, Tongans were hit by the most devastating tropical storm in the island's history. A state of emergency was declared by the nation, which has a population of just over 100,000 people. With destructive winds of over 230 kilometres per hour, the Category 4 cyclone Geeta ripped roofs from houses, brought down trees and caused widespread flooding and carnage across the region. Annalisa Gracias-Moore has more.
Here in Australia, we've experienced cyclones similar to that which occurred in Tonga last week. Cyclone Debbie caused significant devastation to Queensland coastal property and infrastructure, as well as 14 fatalities in March of last year. However, the rest of Australia was quick to respond with aid and resources. For smaller, remote island nations, such as Tonga, the humanitarian crisis following a cyclone of this magnitude is significantly larger due to the lack of surrounding aid and resources. Australia is one of the nations who've responded with humanitarian aid through organisations such as the Red Cross. I spoke to Gemma Snowden, Communications Delegate with the International Federation of the Red Cross, to see what progress has happened and what still needs to be done. Gemma, you're on the ground in Tonga. I understand there's a shortage of shelter almost a week now after the cyclone, and there are many people still in evacuation centres. What's the extent of the situation?
Well, I mean, this was an incredibly strong cyclone that hit Tonga. So the main island of Tongatapu is the most affected area. And officials are saying that it's estimated around 70% of the population has been affected by this. Now, there is a lot of damage to homes, particularly roofs. Some structures have completely fallen over and others are missing, you know, parts of their roof and everything. So Red Cross teams were out the day after the cyclone hit, and they were out delivering relief supplies to people who had been affected by this massive cyclone. And that means shelter kits and tarpaulins to help people rebuild and fix their roofs and try and provide a stable form of shelter, particularly to protect from elements such as the sun and the rain. And so that's been going on for the past week or so.
Do you know how many people have been displaced and how many have been able to go back to their homes now after the cyclone?
I don't have those numbers at hand, but what we do know is that over 1,000 homes were damaged on the main island alone by this cyclone. And, you know, 70% of the population affected in some way. So that's a massive amount of people. And Red Cross and other relief organisations, along with the government, have been out trying to assist those people in need. But also people in Tonga have been helping each other along with the recovery process here. So I met one woman the other day, an 81-year-old, who endured the cyclone alone and was absolutely terrified when her roof started coming off and she sheltered in her bathroom. And by the time the cyclone had passed, at least half of her roof was missing. But, you know, the next day, some students from the local college came over and they fixed it for her. And then the day after that, her neighbours came over and started clearing up her yard for her. So the community has really come together and are supporting each other through this and helping each other out.
So what can Australians do to support the people of Tonga?
So the thing about disasters is that it does bring out the best in humanity, and it does show that people really do want to help out once a disaster has struck. And so the best thing that people can do in this situation is donate money to help assist with relief efforts. So I know that in Australia, Red Cross is taking donations to support their preparedness and recovery disaster funds. So for more information on that, you can go to redcross.org.au.
Gemma Snowden there, Communications Delegate with the International Federation of the Red Cross, ending that report by Annalisa Gracias. A new report done by Reputech shows that 57 of the largest CO2 emitters in Australia have requested to exceed their emissions baseline on the 25th of January just this year. This was granted by the government, allowing an additional 22 million tonnes of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. Given increasing emissions by agriculture and transport, the only thing that could offset these increases is the energy sector, and electricity generation targets seem to be increasingly hard to meet. I asked Associate Professor Hugh Grant from the Australian National University to explain what exactly was meant by these baseline emission levels.
A baseline's annual emissions, which you're not supposed to increase except when they get sort of special approval to do so through new projects or changes to output. But in the normal course of events, they shouldn't increase their emissions above that.
So we're talking like alumina refineries and people like that? Or?
Exactly, that's right. And the whole idea of this is it's a sort of a very weak alternative to sort of policies that have been before, like, say, when emissions were priced, that gave you obviously a financial incentive to reduce emissions if that would reduce your operating costs. This is under their direct action framework that the Liberal Party under Tony Abbott went to the 2013 election with.
So, like, you know, if you've got a lot of targets to meet, you've got extra contracts that have finally come through, and you want to go into full-scale production for a certain amount of time, which is going to give you more emissions, you kind of make an application, do you, to the Department of Environment, and then they say yes or no?
Yes, that's the way it works, as I understand. I'm not familiar with the altogether detail, but it's sort of meant to be for your current level of production, so you can get approvals for a bit more if you, as you said, you get a big new contract overseas to make a whole lot more of whatever, you know, you're producing, like, say, alumina, then you can emit more. But the whole idea of this was meant to be a mechanism that ensured that the direct action projects for reducing the emissions, that payment is actually going to bring about reductions in emissions, which won't be offset by increases somewhere else in the economy from big emitters. And what this report that's just been put out by Reputex is saying, that in fact quite a lot of emissions have been allowed to increase elsewhere, and so quite a lot of the direct action reductions that have been paid for are being offset by these other increases.
Oh, so they're saying that there's 57 facilities across 48 companies which are increasing their emissions as of 25th of January.
And, yes.
But so that they're talking about it being an actual 30% above the levels of 2005.
What this report is saying is that quite a lot of those reductions that are being paid for by taxpayers are actually being, in the sort of general overall accounting, being offset by these emissions that other companies have been allowed to increase.
Right. And does that mean then that we are in danger of not meeting our targets from the Paris Accord?
We are indeed in danger of not meeting our targets. Just before Christmas, when people were thinking about their holidays, the government released a whole lot of different reports related to climate policy and energy policy and so on, and one of them was the projections of Australia's emissions out to 2030, and what these show that starting from now, emissions are actually projected to increase out to 2030, which is rather astonishing when you think that most people believe that we're actually decreasing our emissions in accord with the commitment we made under the Paris Agreement, but they're actually increasing. But they are projected by official government report to be less than they were in the reference year for the Paris Agreement, which was 2005.
So how can Josh Frydenberg say that we're on track to meet the Paris emissions for 2030?
Well, he can only say that by wishful thinking, in my opinion, and these projections certainly don't show that. Policy design says the electricity sector will have to make pro-rata reductions in emissions, that is, pro-rata with the Paris Agreement. In other words, not more than 28% of a reduction from the electricity sector. Well, that means you've got to get 28% reduction from the cattle and 28% from road transport, even though it's actually going up every year by between 1% and 2% at the moment and has been for decades, and so on. So it's really just, it's just rather futile, actually, the way they're talking about it.
Associate Professor Hugh Grant there from the Australian National University, ending that report. I'm Roderick Chambers and you're listening to The Wire. Hundreds of people congregated at the cenotaph on the Esplanade in Darwin to observe the 76th anniversary of the bombing of Darwin this morning. Viktor Petrovich takes us back to February 19, 1942.
Everything was just a normal day. And then we heard the drone of many bombers, and then we saw them come over. We thought they were Americans. They were so in perfect formation. But it was only when the bombs started dropping that we realised that they were the Japanese.
This is Les Brown. He is from the 27th South Australian Scottish Battalion in World War II. He was in Darwin on this day, February the 19th, 76 years ago, when the Japanese army conducted bombing raids over the city. He describes more of what happened that day.
When the Japanese left, they left a horrible mess behind them, and many dead, that kind of thing. But when they went, we went to the shore, and we picked up all our men. We got them back to our battleground and in battle dress into the slit trenches, still not worrying, or worrying from the point of view that a landing could come at any time. What we didn't expect, of course, was the second raid about 12 o'clock.
And the Japanese did return. 260 Japanese bombers descended on Darwin in a series of raids. 243 people were killed and over 400 were injured. Les describes the scene of the aftermath in Darwin.
It's very hard to describe. There is so much devastation. You take the post office. All those young people were killed, and yet they're all heroes because they had every opportunity to move out. But they stayed behind because their equipment was the only equipment that linked with all the states. That's why they stayed there. But the rest, well, houses, the tanks holding millions of gallons of oil, it actually went to sea across the water, caught fire. And some of the sailors who managed to escape from their sinking ships, they had to swim through it. It must have been pretty terrible.
76 years on, the bombing of Darwin is not ingrained into the Australian consciousness in the way that the similarly plotted bombing of Pearl Harbor is for the American people. Norman Clamp is the director of the Darwin Military Museum. He says there are more than a few reasons that we don't all know this as a significant day in our history.
I think it started off immediately after the raids, where the Australian government clamped censorship on the northern part of Australia. They did advise the people that there had been raids, but they played it down, saying that the raids were minimal, there was minimum damage, not a great loss of life. The local newspaper in Darwin was taken over by the military, and that wasn't handed back until about 1946. So a lot of news wasn't coming out about Darwin and that during the war. After the war, I think it was a case of after the same as after the First World War, that people were tired of the war. They didn't want to hear about it anymore. They didn't particularly want to be reminded of what had happened.
Norman thinks our schools can do more to highlight the significance of the bombings.
The really disappointing part is that it would seem that our educators, our Australian educators, aren't of a view that, you know, the events of Darwin, which are really significant in Australian history. I mean, it was the first time that Australian soil was attacked by a foreign force. There were 77 raids over Darwin between February 42 and November 43. There was some, you know, around 230 to 250 people lost their lives in Darwin on that very first day. And yet, you know, 76 years later, people like myself and my colleagues were all saying, why aren't our people being told about this really significant part of our history? And yet we all know about Pearl Harbor, and we all know about, you know, the landings at Normandy and the Battle of Britain, and we know about British kings and queens, and yet we're letting ourselves down by not telling our own story.
97-year-old Norman Cramp ending that report by Viktor Petrovich. For the first time, scientists have watched groups of three photons interacting and effectively producing a new form of light. In results published in Science, researchers suggest that this new light could be used to perform highly complex, incredibly fast quantum computations. Aaron Monopoly helps shed some light on this news discovery.
The next step in computers could see light being at the heart of its processor, bringing into the world super-fast quantum computing. Light is made up of photons that normally go through each other, shine a torch at a torch, and the photons won't interact. However, at MIT, experiments found that it is possible to get three photons to interact with each other, meaning that we will be able to send large amounts of complex quantum data across the world.
Yeah, essentially what they've discovered is that if you shine a weak laser in a cell with rubidium vapor, you can bound photons in pairs or triplets in the cell, and photons are like the fundamental particles of light. And this is actually really exciting because, for example, if you look at hydrogen atom, it's made out of hydrogen molecules can be made of two hydrogen atoms, but not three. Well, here, using particles of light, they can make both molecules having two particles and three particles.
Photons are currently going along fiber optic cables, making the internet exist. Having photons interacting with each other means faster transmission of quantum data. The possibility of this finding is immense in a lot of areas. Being able to send large amounts of complex information quickly over incredible distances would help expand a range of areas: medical and health, business, scientific research.
In terms of applications, if you can have control of how many particles of light you have and at what time, this gives you potential to build a so-called quantum computer. That's a computer that's going to be billions of times faster than computers that we have today for calculating certain problems.
The possibility of this finding is immense in a lot of areas. Being able to send large amounts of complex information quickly over incredible distances would help expand a range of areas: medical and health, business, scientific research.
Let's say definitely over 10 years, so that's currently at the very sort of basic level.
It is possible in the next 10 years, we could see a giant leap in the processing speed of computers and the transfer of data across the world. But lightsabers from Star Wars are highly unlikely.
Yeah, at this point I would say it's a bit far-fetched, so I would say realistic implications would be faster computers and better internet.
It seems that the future of super-fast computing is coming quickly. But is this technology arriving at the speed of light? Or is it coming at a turtle's pace?
Oh yes, Alexander Solnetsev ending that report by Aaron Monopoly. Opponents of a glamping development in the Royal National Park are set to launch a legal challenge against the New South Wales government. New South Wales Environment Minister Gabrielle Upton has approved plans for a road to the site, paving the way for the eco-tourism project to be built. But residents are fighting to save Spring Gully, where the development is set to be built. Henry Tai asked the Spring Gully Protection Group Chairman Mark De Silva about this now five-year-long fight to save their community.
In a small corner of the Royal National Park, a new glamping spot has caused quite the stir. Mark De Silva, a spokesperson from the Spring Gully Protection Group, says they aren't pleased with the approval of a road going through the park and will be fighting the decision.
We intend to challenge the Minister for the Environment in court. She has granted road access through the Royal National Park to the proposed Eco Lodge in Spring Gully at the south of Bundina. And this is going to lead to the clearing of over 430 trees from a critically endangered ecological community, an incredibly valuable threatened species habitat, just for the building of 6 safari tents for 12 tourists.
Mr. De Silva disagrees that the Eco Lodge will bring many more jobs. Indeed, the region already has more than 200 similar establishments, and Mr. De Silva notes that the ecological expense of the road, compared to the benefit of some 12 beds, is out of proportion.
There are currently over 240 private bed and breakfast and short-stay holiday rentals in the Bundina area. And in addition to that, there are 300 camping spots in the Royal National Park just next to Bundina. So these 12 additional tourist beds are not really that economically significant in the scheme of things. And of course, we're all for ecotourism, and we're all for people, you know, coming in and discovering the beautiful Royal National Park. But the idea of doing that at the expense of over 430 trees and destroying threatened species habitat is completely absurd. It's not ecotourism, in our opinion, and it's not in the interests of the environment.
In a statement provided to The Wire, the New South Wales Office of Environment and Heritage said,
"The proposed development is located on private land. Any matters relating to the proposed development are for the Eco Lodge to answer. The New South Wales National Parks and Wildlife Services has issued a licence which allows access along the existing sealed management trail to the property consistent with the in-holding policy and Section 153C of the National Parks and Wildlife Act, which specifically enables owners of the private land to be granted a right to access their land in certain circumstances. The development applications for the Eco Lodge were approved, subject to conditions, by the Land and Environment Court."
There are indeed risks beyond devastating the local ecology, risks which include the lives of campers.
The local RFS and the Sutherland Shire District RFS both asked for the development to be refused on bushfire safety grounds. Spring Gully is one of the most bushfire-prone areas in the Royal National Park. You know, there's a common thread of thought that it's just madness to build this tourist facility here, not just because it puts the lives of the inhabitants at danger. It stretches the resources of the volunteer firefighters that may need to go in there in the case of having to evacuate. And what we've seen through the court processes that this development appeal went through is a lot of very creative interpreting of the Rural Fire Service building code, a lot of very creative interpretations of things like slopes and types of vegetation. And really, I think when you look at this, it doesn't pass the common sense test.
Spring Gully Protection Group Chairman Mark De Silva ending that report by Henry Tai. That's it for The Wire today. We'll be back again tomorrow, so please tune in again then. Today's program came from the studios of Radio 2 SER in Sydney on Gadigal country of the Eora Nation. I'm Roderick Chambers. Thanks for your company.
across Australia.
Don't even want it on my skin.